Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another The One-Liner podcast from the Edinburgh International Film Festival. I am Scott Morris, and over there is Drew Davendale.
Hello.
Yep, a whole eight films to get cracking through this time, so we'll just head straight on in with Fish Tank, which reads like Billy Elliot meets Sweet 16. But Drew, would you fill us in on some details?
This is yet another of the low-budget, working-class urban dramas that Britain seems to be so very prolific in producing. And it's typically depressing, as you might expect, but importantly, it's also very good. It's about 15-year-old Mia, who lives with her younger sister and foul-mouthed, open-legged and entirely self-interested mother in a household where the customary morning greeting consists of four-letter words. A very pleasant family indeed.
It's not hi-hi, is it?
No, nor is it eggs.
Which would probably be more disturbing, to be frank. It's eggs.
I don't know, it might make sense in the morning as a demand for breakfast. The requisite please and thank yous in place, but I'm sure you can work out what four-letter words are there. And it's typically the more extreme of the two, or what's considered the more extreme of the two, which makes it even worse. Anyway, expelled from school, Mia fills her days drinking, breaking into empty flats to practice dancing, and generally clashing with anyone she meets. But mostly, though, she spends her days being lonely. But then things begin to look up when her mother's new boyfriend, Connor, arrives in her life. Here's someone who's who bothers to engage her in conversation, he takes an interest in her life, he cares about her well-being, and generally is doing all the things that a parent ought to do, but her mother doesn't. But as you can imagine, all might not go well, this being the type of films it is. Speak too much more of the plot, that's not necessarily important, but then, like, while this spiky Mia quite often comes across as a brat, it's hard not to at least feel, you know, some sympathy for her, given her waste of space mother and the entire lack of concern or interest she shows for her elder daughter, not that her younger sibling is treated much better. The film's as much an indictment of bad parenting as anything else. Unfortunately, the acting is excellent from all the leads, most notably Katie Jarvis, who does a really superb job of portraying Mia as a flint-edged teenager but with a believably vulnerable and damaged soul inside. The director and screenwriter, Andrea Arnold, paints a pretty believable portrait of teenaged angst and frustration, and that's the legitimate, I've got a really shitty life and I must get out of it kind of angst, as opposed to the, oh, woe is me, nobody understands me tripe that characterises so many other coming-of-age tales. But Arnold also makes her heroine neither an angel nor a demon, but just a believable human being. Unfortunately, the events which follow Connor's introduction are predictable, and the character of Mia's mum perhaps borders on cliché at times. And not, of course, that that necessarily makes the character any less believable, but neither of them are fatal flaws, fortunately. And unlike a lot of films of the type, there's no message of hope in here, which is refreshing, but it's hardly uplifting. Still, though, it's rewarding, if incredibly downbeat viewing, so I would recommend this quite highly.
It sounds very British. And by British, I mean depressing.
I do believe it's how I set it out to make it seem, because that's the case. There's an awful lot of very similar type of films in Britain. It's been going a good few years now. Like things like Bullet Boy, etc. spring to mind too, and pretty much anything done by Ken Loach. Fortunately, this is definitely more on the Ken Loach scale than a lot of them. It's a very, very good film. It's just really bleak.
Yeah, thanks, Thatcher. Biting political satire there.
About 25 years out of date, unfortunately.
Look, it's still working for Ben Elton. It'll still work for me.
That's bleak, but fortunately good. Fortunately, though, saw something yesterday that has quite a lot of hype attached to it after its award-winning showing at Cannes last month. But unfortunately, this one not really got a lot of merit. But Scott, tell us all about it.
You're spoiling the surprise. Yeah, I'd perhaps be lying if I said I was looking forward to Antichrist, but I was at least somewhat interested in it. But then again, it is a horror, and horror is almost always synonymous with god-awful. And this is sadly no exception. Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg are a couple who are devastated by the loss of their child, shown in the prologue. And after that, Charlotte Gainsbourg has something of a mental breakdown, and in order, for some reason, to deal with their grief, the goalposts suddenly shift into fears for reasons that I'm not entirely sure about. And it is somehow discovered that Charlotte Gainsbourg is scared of their log cabin retreat in the woods of Eden. So in order to face their fear, off they go, into the woods, and this is pretty much all that happens for about 75 minutes. I'm not exaggerating when I say that the most interesting that happens once the prologue ends is some acorns fall on a roof. That's all you get for 75 minutes. It is tremendously tedious. Now, it's very well shot and lovely cinematographised tedium, but it is still tedium nonetheless.
Yeah, you're wrong though, Scott, because the 75 minutes is pretty much like a session between a psychologist and a patient. That's clearly incredibly interesting. Oh, wait, no, right, yes, you're right, carry on.
Utterly, utterly tedious. Now, it does perk up a little after that. I mean, you get a talking fox, and after... Don't laugh at the talking fox, it's the very embodiment of dread.
That's what you said to me during the film too, right before you said you spent 50 minutes when you were trying to get to sleep the next night laughing constantly at the idea of the talking fox.
And well, essentially after that, a little bit more tedium, and then we go on to the realms of torture porn, and that is all that it is. It is frankly sickening to think that this is getting any more slack than you would give something like Hostel or Saw 5, because there's literally nothing to this film. It is less than nothing. All you get is a lot of nonsense leading up to some torture porn that is in no way shocking and in no way provocative. It is in no way edgy. It is just nonsense on screen. There is literally nothing to this film. It is an absolute disgrace.
Yeah, the film has absolutely no merit at all. I mean, it doesn't even try to please, say, just me by, once it introduces a talking fox, showing some footage of the foxes locked in their eternal battle against their arch enemy, the polar bear, for control of the foxes' glacier mints.
For all the hype this is getting about becoming the, like, these shocking scenes and all of it, so, oh, look at all of this graphic sex and all that, I mean, I don't know if it's years of desensitisation from internet pornography or the simple fact that I own one of my own, but I am just not shocked by the sight of an erect phallus. It's fairly mundane at this point in my life. And I have, however, seen quite enough of Willem Dafoe's arse to last me for the rest of my life. You get used to that sight because you will see quite a lot of it, whether you want to or not. It just utterly fails at being shocking, artistic, provocative. There's just nothing there. It exists purely in this bubble of its own hype and expectations. I just do not understand why anyone could watch this film. I'm not angry because it is supposedly misogynistic or anything. Like, I'm just angry because it's so incredibly tedious.
Yeah, it's just frankly utterly rubbish. It's got no merit whatsoever. And I can't understand the awards buzz it's getting. It's like, oh, it's Lars von Trier. We must give him some award. And I remember a few years ago absolutely dreading the thought of von Trier's Dogville. It had some of the most pretentious trailers I'd ever seen, and in the end I loved the film, and had one of the most, well, just one of the best endings of a film I'd seen in many, many years, with a lovely warm tingly feeling in my insides. And if you've seen Dogville, you know just what a twisty person I am to think that, but this I was expecting to be disappointed but hoping it'd be another Dogville, but alas, no, it's just rotten. There's no merit to it at all. There's nothing provocative, and just because something's provocative doesn't make it good anyway. But there's nothing provocative, there's nothing interesting, there's nothing scary, there's nothing creepy, there's only one shot of a talking fox. It's all bad.
Oh yeah. I can only assume it's been cut some slack because Lars von Trier is something of a critical darling. I mean, if this had come from Eli Roth, I mean, the first 90 minutes would have been slammed for being incredibly pretentious, which they are, and the last half an hour would have been slammed for being really crap, which it is. And the fact that no one's really pointing this out, even, I've seen some people give this 5 stars, and even when you read the review, they can't come up with any good reason for why they're giving it 5 stars. They just seem like, well, it's, I would normally give this nothing, because it would come from, I don't know, Eli Roth or someone along those lines. But just because it's Lars von Trier, they're thinking, oh, well, must like it then, because I must like it. And thankfully, there's at least a good few people who went, no, actually, it's terrible. But even then, a lot of people are saying it's terrible for precisely the wrong reasons. I did not find this even slightly shocking. And I'm not a man of steel here. It is quite possible to shock me fairly easily. But this just is not going to do it.
But there's nothing shocking in it. I mean, there's a few unpleasant-looking moments. But, I mean, even the way I had expected it to be in terms of hearing about, see, a shot of penetration, so I was expecting it to be another 9 songs, and it's every bit as good as 9 songs.
Not a compliment, by the way.
Yes, that was sarcasm for those who are not aware of our feelings about Michael Winterbottom's 9 songs, but it's just terrible. I just get angry about it now because it's so awful when I wasted my afternoon watching it. Grr, arg. Sorry, I think we spent too long talking about this. Just hopefully we put people off going to it because it is bad.
Yeah, just avoid it. It's the worst film we've seen this year. And I don't mean that in the way that a lot of people would say, like, tell you it's the worst film of the year. It's just the most boring film we've seen this year. Yeah, avoid it. So, right, moving on, as we better do. Steven Soderbergh, Escorts, The Girlfriend Experience. That's pretty much the limit of my knowledge, so Drew, fill us in.
Unfortunately, actually, this is about as interesting as Antichrist, but about a half an hour shorter, so therefore less bad from that point of view. This is just astonishingly pointless. It's like Bloomberg with added prostitutes. The film boils down to the mundanities of a call girl's daily life. We hear Christine, or Chelsea as she's professionally known, read her diary in voiceover, which imparts such gripping information as, I wore a black dress and lapel lingerie. We went to a movie, then dinner, then had sex for an hour. In the morning he talked to me about the economy. There then follows another 70 minutes more of equally enthralling snippets from Chelsea's journal, as well as following her to meetings with website designers, where they discuss how to improve her Google search rankings, meetings with accountants, where they discuss financial options, or meetings with clients, where they moan about how the recession has affected their businesses, but not their prostitute budgets, apparently.
Well, you always ring-fence that at the start of the year.
Yeah.
But I'll certainly do.
As an added happy bonus, we also get to see Chelsea's tests with her boyfriend, and the boyfriend's fascinatingly exciting trips to a sports store to try and get them to sell some of his entirely indistinguishable from everything else clothing line. The Girlfriend Experience is about financial advice for hookers and how the credit crunch is affecting the business of selling your body. It's all quite astonishingly dull and astonishingly pointless, and you should just take astonishing levels of pain to miss this.
Yeah, but it's shorter than Antichrist, so, you know, that's a bonus.
It's at least 30 minutes less bad.
Yes.
I was expecting something along the lines perhaps of Full Frontal, where Steven Soderbergh took a right turn right up his own bum. It was just so pretentious and awful. And it's not even that, it's just dull. I fail to see the point of the film at all.
Steven Soderbergh's a bit of a weird fruit, isn't he? Right. He'll pull out the occasional film that I really like Out of Sight, or he was a Traffic, wasn't he?
Traffic, yeah. I mean, even sort of knockabout stuff like Ocean's 11, Ocean's 13, less said about the middle one, the better. I mean, they're fluff, but they are entertaining. And you see there's a really good vibe to the film, and it makes it an enjoyable thing.
It's like he can sort of switch between sort of really entertaining, really breezy films and just rampantly tedious ones at will, and that's the only two films that he can make. It's strange. I mean, even things that were, I could see some degree of worth in, like Solaris, you know, just tedious, and then less said about Full Frontal the better.
Yes.
A strange fruit.
So, on to something else then, I think. So, something in foreign language-wise, Scott Breathless, which I actually know nothing about. I think you've told me, but I wasn't listening. Sorry about that.
It's the particular South Korean brand of foreign, and I have, I suppose, been somewhat disappointed by South Korean's output that's made it over here in recent years. After the Chan-wook Park-filled heyday of absolute mentalness like Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance and Old Boy and the likes, there seems to have been something of a glut of mainstream nonsense that isn't really particularly entertaining, it doesn't really do much different, and I'm not saying it's worse than anything that Hollywood produced, but it lacked that edge. I'm thinking of things like The Host and The Chaser, which they're not bad films, but I just didn't really see the point of them. There was some hope for optimism with Breathless, which is the first feature-length outing from the young director Ik Jun Yang. It picked up a fair bit of hype, and I don't think it justifies all of that hype, but it does justify at least some of it, and it's a startling calling card from the young man. He himself plays Sang Hoon, who is a thug, who works for his older friend, who is also a thug, and they run a gang of thugs for hire. So if you have a problem and no one else can help, then maybe you could call a gang of thugs. So having set themselves up both as a hired muscle and a loan sharking slash collection agency, it might be redundant to say that Sang Hoon is not a nice guy, but he is not a nice guy. You know, what with all the thuggery and that. At least the proceeds of his antics aren't completely wasted. A good portion goes to help his nephew and half-sister. His relationship with his father is largely characterised by Sang Hoon swearing at and punching said father. With some reason, he had accidentally killed Sang Hoon's younger sister some years in the past, and he's just been released from prison. I say accidentally, she really just got in the way of one of the frequent beatings doled out in the mother-father relationship. The mother then promptly walks into the road and gets killed by a passing bus. Happy families. Another happy family lives just down the road. Schoolgirl Yeon-hee initially finds herself just another target of Sang Hoon's expletive-filled campaign of disrespect for everybody, although having had the temerity to question him on his actions earns her some respect with Sang Hoon. Well, actually, it earns her a punch to the face. But once that's over, the two become friends of sorts. Her life's no less shitty than Sang-hoon's. Her mother's dead, her father, a Vietnam vet, needs to be cared for and has delusions that her wife is actually still alive and just sleeping with other men. And that's before her elder brother starts a new job with Sang-hoon's thuggery squad and also starts to embrace casual violence as a valid lifestyle choice. Now, words like powerful and shocking get thrown about far too often for films and they often don't deserve them. Breathless comes about as close to deserving that title as anything else I've seen this year in the EIFF. On the surface, it's just another gangster flick, but at heart, it's more about the horrors of domestic violence and the strange thing that a family unit is. Now, as a film, it's not perfect. It's a shade too long, especially the opening acts. It spends a very long time and very effectively establishes Sang-hoon as a complete arsehole, but it does too good a job of it. Having established him as such an unsympathetic character, when the inevitable final act turn towards redemption turns, it just doesn't have the emotional hold that it needs, what with Sang-hoon being a total git and all that.
Yeah, you're probably going to want to be killed rather than redeemed, surely, character
yeah.
like that.
Now, that aside, there's still enough to recommend this to anyone who's had a passing interest in Korean cinema beforehand. It's perhaps not the film to convert people to the cause, if there will, but it certainly shows a style and an edge that a lot of the filmmakers from South Korea seem to have eschewed in favour of a more mass market acceptance, if you could say that. If nothing else, it does mark out Ik Jun Yang as a filmmaker to keep a very close eye on the years coming forward. I'm sure this will not wind up being his strongest work, but it is a very impressive debut.
That's one worth checking out at some point. Yeah, it's a spate of maybe about 3, maybe 4 years of some really interesting stuff coming to South Korea. The Vengeance trilogy, which you mentioned, and things like the, quite frankly, utterly awesome Public Enemy.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it's just the stuff, certainly the stuff that's been making over here the last few years, is just not matched up at all. And the stuff which is actually quite different from that, but it's still good, like With a Girl of Black Soil from last year's EIFF, yeah. Just not mainstream enough for most people to get a chance to see. Hopefully this gets a fairly decent release, so it's got a decent DVD release in this country.
It's certainly far more worthy of attention than something like, say, The Chaser, which seemed to be sold, certainly in this country, purely on the basis that it was about to be remade by an American studio company, which just seems daft.
Well, yeah, it wasn't really good to be made in good enough to be made once, let alone twice.
Exactly. So, moving on, back to Home Shores, I believe, for Running in Traffic.
A film very close to home, being set in Glasgow. Although, actually, the reason I chose this film out of the 5 or 6 options I had of a similar time was because one of the actors in it I was friends with at high school. Went into that thinking that was a good reason, and also with some optimism. Tell a bit about it first, though. It's Running Traffic begins with 2 deaths. Kayla miscarries her baby at the same time as Joe's father's dying from cancer, and their 2 lives begin to unravel. As the one person's life sort of falls apart through his own actions, Kayla's life just becomes gradually shittier, and as their lives get worse and worse, their stories intersect, or at least touch, in several places. Now, I mean, quite why this film structures like that, I don't know, whether it's perhaps to indicate the randomness of life or the certainty of chance, I don't know, but there's no meaning to any of them, and there's nothing to take from the story. The events of their lives are separate, and any connection between them just seems so forced and tenuous, but on the upside, it's not quite Babel. I mean, there are a few good things with the film. One of the most successful and effective elements is the relatively sparse use of dialogue. I mean, especially in the opening act of the film, a huge amount is conveyed through what's not said, you know, through sighs and body language and the eyes. And it's really well done, with particular credit going to Brian Larkin's Joe for his non-verbal performance, and to a lesser extent, Ross Maxwell and Anna Kerth. Well, they're given less to do in that respect, I suppose. Another problem was Kenneth Cranham's Bill, a family member of Joe's who gets him to do some shady dealings in exchange for some cash, is woefully miscast. I mean, he needs to be both compassionate family member and menacing danger, but he doesn't achieve either. And also, deliberate pacing may all be very well, but there still has to be a point and substance. And simply not enough happens in the film's 96-minute running time that is in any way compelling. And there's promise, though, in particularly Brian Larkin, as well as Ross Maxwell, who I went to high school with. And I'd certainly be eager to see either of them again, given something more compelling and substantial. And, well, you know, let's be brutally honest here, enjoyable. Which, unfortunately, this wasn't. So it's something of a disappointment. And I certainly wouldn't encourage anyone to see it. But it's, you know, it's perhaps worth bearing in mind the names of the actors for the future. And if you see them again, worth checking them out. They certainly show me promise.
Good stuff. Better or worse than 21 grams?
It's probably less pretentious, so therefore better.
Fair enough. If it was better than Babel and better than 21 grams, then must be 5 stars. There we go.
That's not directed by Lars von Trier. Give it 4.
Fair enough.
Hey, though, fortunately, it's another film we both managed to catch, and a particular favourite genre of mine, the film noir. But this had the potential to be a bit crap, quite frankly, going by how it was described. But fortunately, it wasn't. Scott, please tell the people listening why.
Yeah, the neo-noir genre that's dug up frequently and made to shuffle around zombie-like for a while before it collapses back to the earth for another couple of years. I think the last time we saw it in earnest was Brick from a few years back, which incidentally was fantastic. This time round, though, we see an ex-cop turned private detective, John Roscoe, played by Michael Shannon, just as he's given a new case. This time to tail one Harold Fulmer, who's currently headed across country with a young child in tow, not Fulmer's own kid. And so it goes, although if I give you the blow-by-blow of the plots, then it's perhaps somewhat counterproductive in actually getting you to see the film, because the ride is perhaps one of the main reasons you might want to go and see it. And I think you should go and see it. While films like this and Brick might well be taking these old genre staples and just wallowing in them, it's a damnably enjoyable wallow. Shannon himself is excellent as the grizzled, alcoholic, wisecracking detective, a protagonist that seems as out of place in the modern world as the film does in modern cinemas. It's often blisteringly funny, and while the narrative probably wouldn't hold enough interest over repeat viewings, it's certainly more than compelling enough to warrant a once-through, and the characters are, for the most part, tremendously interesting. Details about Roscoe and Fulmer's prior lives and how they've changed after both being caught up in the attacks on the World Trade Center are doled out throughout the piece, and it provides a welcome depth to characters that would otherwise be enjoyable but ultimately disposable elements in an enjoyable but ultimately disposable film. Now, I'm not saying it's the definitive handling of post-9/11 trauma, but it's a far more respectful handling of it than, say, Oliver Stone's World Trade Center. It treats the attacks as a defining event in people's lives for sure, but not the entirety of it. It's using events to inform characters rather than simply make a spectacle of an atrocity. So it's funny, cynical, enjoyable and engaging. So custom built to appeal to me then, and well worth seeking out.
I don't really have anything to add to that. It's film noir, which I love, and like Brick, it's a good modern stab at it. It's not quite as polished or enjoyable or just as good as Brick, but It's certainly a compelling story. It's interesting, and Michael Shannon's Russell is a really interesting character. It's really well played, and you ought not to like the character. I mean, he's a miserable alcoholic. He's just miserable. He seems pretty incompetent. He's not pleasant to people, and yet he is very, very watchable, and you want him to succeed. It's quite a neat trick.
Yeah, it does manage. The moment you mention 9/11 in relation with any film, you immediately go, oh, this is going to be mawkish and moping and depressing and have lots of slow motion shots of people crying and that. And it sideswipes all that quite effectively. And yeah, so for that reason alone, probably makes it one of the best films that actually deals with 9/11 in any meaningful way.
Yeah.
Okay, crashing on. Another British film promises to be a thriller / sci-fi monster movie, but I've noted who's doing the promising on this one, so instead I will defer to Drew for the details.
You can't possibly mean promises made by Hannah McGill, can you?
Shh, we've got to come back next year.
Yeah, well, apparently this time Hannah McGill hasn't even watched it, because although it's not in the public guide, in the media guide, media catalogue for the press and the industry, she mentions that, I mean, you may think they're fairly inconsequential, but for instance, explaining that the main character's a doctor, which is actually a lawyer, kind of important because it means she can't treat some of the people she finds that are injured later on. That's significant. And suggesting that later on has special effects, when by special effects she means a latex mask. I'm guessing she hasn't watched it, which is slightly worrying. But yes, as you say, it's another British film. And I hadn't actually intended to see quite so many British films this year. It being an international film festival, I'd like to see as many from many different corners of the globe as possible. Scheduling forced this into my hand. And unfortunately, it's yet another one to add to my pretty abysmal hit rate for British films this year. I don't spend too much on it, because there's very little substance to the film. It's largely a teenage girl goes to stay with her mum for Christmas. She hardly ever sees her. She's shown no interest in her, really. Her mother's preferred to concentrate on her career as a lawyer. Instead, yeah, just after arriving at her mother's house, suddenly there's a military presence on the street, somebody gets shot, people are told to stay in their houses, and people start dying. There's bugger all of interest. The idea being here, some sort of military experiment gone wrong, some sort of monstrous creature going around killing everybody, and just rubbish. I really don't want to spend much more time explaining why. Just trust me, it's only 79 minutes long, and it still feels too long, because even though it's quite weirdly, this might not make much sense to you, but it's like quite tight, quickly paced, yet nothing happens. And for a monster movie or sort of a slasher, might not be an inappropriate thing to apply to what it's trying to do too. There's absolutely no feeling of threat at all, and the acting is bad. Neve McIntosh's mother, Beth, her character is just over the top, and everybody else is just a bit meh. You know, so you're like, eh, you're all a bit rubbish, are you going to die yet? And it being the type of film as they mostly do. So that's good. Next. Oh, I'm sorry, but you may want more information. There's not really anything more to say about it. It's a monster movie that's not scary, not monstrous. I mean, you actually see the monster, laughable.
It's starting to sound a bit like The Mist, but with everything that made The Mist good taken out of it. A brave decision. So, want to dodge then?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Fortunately, though, our hit rate of British films isn't completely zero, and one of the best we've seen, not only one of the best we've seen at the festival at all, is from a particular favourite director of mine, and director of my favourite film of last year in total, and from last year's film festival, the quite incredible Shane Meadows, who I have never seen a bad film by, called Le Donc and Scorsese. This oddly named film, though, Scott, why were it good?
Well, this is Shane Meadows attempting to do for roadies what Spinal Tap did for fake rock acts. Le Donc, in this case, is the roadie, played by Paddy Constantine, and Shane Meadows follows around in a sort of Guestian mockumentary fashion type doodad. So Mr. Donk has found himself separated from his heavily pregnant wife and moved in with the young rap artist Scorsese. This is the basic setup, just as Shane joins us for this little documentary that he's just going to follow him about with. And soon the Donk is called out to help upon backstage with the setup for a big Arctic Monkeys gig, who I believe are some sort of young beat combo popular with the young set. The two hop in a camper van, make the long trip to Manchester, and with Le Donc having the ulterior motive of blagging a support act slot for the young heavyweight rapper, and Meadows and crew are just tagging along for the ride. Now, narratively, there's not a lot more to the film than that. It's not exactly a movie of drama and conflict. It's played very strictly for laughs, and a goal achieved with some embarrassing ease, especially compared to some of the other non-com drivel that I've sat through this year. I continually forget that Paddy Constantine's actually a pretty good comedic actor, witness if nothing else Hot Fuzz. As such, it shouldn't really be a surprise when he turns out to be massively funny as Le Donc. He plays the worst kind of inconsiderate, charmless idiot, one who thinks he is a considerate, charming, smooth operator. Support from youngster Scorsese, who, joking aside, is actually a fairly talented and funny lyricist in his own right, is charming, and crucially also very funny, and Shane Meadows himself turns out to be quite funny, albeit in a film where the fourth wall isn't so much broken as never built in the first place. The only things that don't work, and I'll readily admit that this is a matter of personal preference, is that there's a couple of montages over scenes of the Arctic Monkeys music, which I don't like, because I don't like the Arctic Monkeys. Perhaps a silly reason to start picking on the film, but as it's a fairly short film, at about 80 minutes, it does actually take up a fairly large percentage of the film. It's perhaps unfair to pick the only things that I can really criticise a film for being basically musical taste, but that does of course play a big part in the film. Right, but other than that, it's absolutely hilarious, and it's definitely well worth seeing. I don't know if the name Le Donc and Scorsese will survive until it makes it to cinemas, because it seemed to basically get changed on the day of the screening for us, and it's still a stupid name, so I suspect it might wind up changing at some point down the line, but no matter what it's called, definitely try and go and see it.
Oh yeah, well, its name on IMDb is currently still Le Donc and Scorsese, but of course that could change. But yeah, no, it's quite surprising, but it's 71 minutes, but it's pretty much non-stop humour in that.
Yeah.
It's just really enjoyable, it proves just what a good filmmaker Shane Meadows is. You just can't make a bad film. I've never seen a bad film by him, so I'm certainly hoping I'd never ever do.
I suppose in this one, it's largely so good because he's surrounding himself with people that are so talented. This was apparently almost completely improvised and shot in 5 days, which is a very tight production, but it's...
The dog was a character that Considine had created some time before, possibly to amuse Shea Meadow or something like that. That's the idea.
I don't know what their history is, but I noticed that some of the earliest short films that Shane Meadows has done, like the 9 or 10 minute shorts, were Le Donc and something else. There's a few other sort of Le Donc starring ones, so I don't know whether that's the same character or what. They're not ones I've seen from back in 91 or something like that. But yeah, seemingly perhaps an existing character that he's just re-inhabiting.
So the usual mixed bag there, but a couple of strong recommendations you might want to check out. Le Donc, Fish Tank and Breathless, certainly all worth a look, and The Missing Person as well. So we are off now to go and see some more films to bring you the news on, and we'll see you shortly. Goodbye for now. I've been Drew. Goodbye. And he's been Scott.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Through Tavendale, ready!
Yeah, I don't think they said anything, Gladiators, did they? They just sort of looked nervous. This is me looking nervous down the microphone.
You never do the proper Gladiators intro. Surely the correct response to that would have been, Scott Morris, ready. Let's write it off as a bad idea.